Welcome everybody. Today I have as my guest Gary Heseltine, one of the leading figures of the international UFO community. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, I know a little bit about you, but I think it's better that you tell the audience and me about your background and why you started doing this and what made you interested and got you hooked on this interesting subject.
Okay, my interest in the subject of UFOs originally began with a childhood sighting when I was 16. Cutting a long story short, I saw a strange white light that appeared to trigger a number of power cuts in the area. I moved geographically via my bicycle to a second area where I lived. And so from the first sighting to the second sighting was about a mile distant. And as the object passed over my rooftop, I put my arm up in the, like answering a question in the class, and then no sooner did it go past my arm, the whole area was plunged into darkness. And that was ridiculous, because how could I predict a power cut? So I knew that that object, whatever it was, had somehow interacted with the power grid, because I'd moved geographically about a mile and predicted it literally to the second. So that's what kicked off my interest, but I didn't do anything really. I joined a local UFO club briefly, but I all thought they were crazy, so I didn't stay. I then kind of went away and had a life. I joined the Air Force. I was in the Air Force Police for 6 years until 1989. Came out in 1989, joined the British Transport Police in the UK, and then went on to have a 24-year career, the last 19 years of which was as a detective. I was an advanced interviewer of suspects and witnesses, and my particular interest lay in interviewing people. I liked the psychology, so as an advanced interviewer I was qualified to interview for murder, manslaughter, rape. I was also involved in the London bombers terrorist incident, interviewing first responding police officers to the various three of the four scenes, which was really interesting. While I was still a serving detective, in 2002 I launched an unofficial national database to collect British police officer UFO sightings. And I began with half a dozen sightings involving maybe 10 or 12 officers. Now, all these years later, I have over 550 cases, going back to 1901, involving 1,100 officers approximately.
Wow.
So a lot. And that's how I became known within the UFO community. I'd never done lectures of any kind. I'd always been a comfortable speaker, but never done anything on a big scale. But then I began to get a lot of media because I was a police officer and giving credibility to the subject.
But you weren't able to work with this within the police force?
No. That was like shunned, and I was kind of told that it probably wouldn't be good for my career, and it wasn't, because as time went on and the more successful I became, the more rules they imposed on me. And was one of the reasons why I decided to leave early. I left in 2013 to create my own online e-zine called UFO Truth Magazine, which is a PDF format that's sent bi-monthly, 96 pages featuring articles by most of the top researchers that I've met over the years. I've been internationally lecturing since 2010 and probably done now 21 countries so far. So I'm very lucky that I've made my passion into a job, and continued it after I retired from the police, and so I can't count myself very lucky.
And you're now the vice president of something called the ICER.
International Coalition for Extraterrestrial Research. Yeah, this stems from originally a Chinese initiative from 2018. A couple of colleagues who were involved earlier than me in the project were asked to go to China. And they had, they were asked to go back and identify suitable researchers to come together as a coalition to try to, I guess, create a disclosure type movement internationally. As part of that process, I was asked to go to Moscow in October of 2018. And there was nine of us met with the Chinese delegation. This was unofficial. But you say unofficial because nothing happens in China without it being official.
True.
So we had this discussion, and the idea was to create the coalition in a kind of international disclosure moment. Unfortunately, after a year, there was no activity to to follow upon the promises that the Chinese had made. So basically, in that sense, the Chinese initiative ended.
Yeah.
But it coincided that by early 2020, just in time for the first lockdown in the UK, so March, April of 2020, everybody was then using Zoom as a way to keep in touch with relatives. So I said, well, we'd already identified maybe 15 or 16 potential countries to get involved, researchers-wise. And I said, well, perhaps this is the time to try the Zoom. So I took out a professional Zoom account and then started getting people together. And from there, we then began to prepare for a public release. We registered as an international NGO, non-government organization. So we're not a group. We have laws that EU laws, because we're registered in Portugal, and we launched in May of 2021, and we now have 30 national representatives. So in UFO terms, it's a mixture of UFO experts, scientists and academics, which is a very unusual mix in this subject. And the broader aim is to prepare people for what we think is going to be a coming paradigm shift, which is this, we talk about this disclosure with a big D, and what we mean by that is when it's universally acknowledged 24/7 on the news that ET is real, or there is an interdimensional non-human presence interacting with planet Earth.
Yeah.
So that's what we're trying to do. We're developing courses to for all sectors of society, religion, aviation, education, etc. We've just done our first free, at the point of access, evidential history course, which I ran and put on, and we'll be running another course in the next few months. So the idea is to start to prepare people, because we feel that the world is vastly underprepared, and with the things that are taking place in America, we think that, you know, there's a real possibility in the next 2 years, this admission, shall we say, or acknowledgement that we're dealing with a non-human interaction is going to come true. And I think the vast majority of people, because the subject has been so ridiculed for so long, are unprepared, or certainly a section of the public will be underprepared, like COVID, with lockdowns and the psychological trauma that it caused to people. So I think we're trying to just, in our own way, trying to get the international community together to say, look, all governments, all nations now need to accept that this is about to come true, and you have done nothing to prepare the public, because you've led to believe that there was nothing. So there's going to be this real culture shock if we're not careful, and so that's what we're trying to do. And we're trying to take our aims to the highest levels of governance. We've got a project going called Project Titan, which is basically a small country, San Marino. I met with a culture minister, and we gave our plans for Project Titan. And Project Titan is basically, you need a nation state to sponsor you, in a sense.
So you get a foot into the
UN. Yes, so it has to be at national level.
Yeah.
So we have gone to San Marino, who have a long association with one of the local Italian UFO groups, and so they basically know that and have helped fund conferences in the past for the last 30 years. So there is a bond there already. So now we've gone back to them and say, look, now is the time that we would like you to adopt our initiative and approach the UN on behalf of San Marino to make San Marino the United Nations capital for further research into the extraterrestrial, and that's be funded. So a bit like the Geneva Convention for the Second World War and how to treat people as captives, this would put San Marino on the map, so it'd be good for tourism, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I understand that you focus mainly on modern day UFO reports, I mean the reports that have been coming from since the Roswell incident in 1947 and onwards, and you don't delve very much into like ancient documents that could be interpreted as if they were describing UFOs
landing. I mean, we totally acknowledge that there are lots of strange aerial sightings that have gone back thousands of years, However, because it's too far back, we concentrate on what we would call the modern era, so from the 1940s onwards. And, you know, we're basically saying the last 75 years, all of our representatives have had to sign an oath, which was basically saying, based on the evidence of the last 75 years, based on pilots, radar operators, air traffic controllers, etc., very credible people, that there is, based on that high quality reporting, there is a small percentage of UFO cases that we believe is dealing with a non-human, i.e. probably extraterrestrial, but there may also be an interdimensional aspect. Either way, it's non-human. And so that's why we've all put out that oath, because we want to be like-minded, and that puts us all together on the same page. And so far, so good. You know, we're having behind the scenes, we're having meetings with diplomats and things like that. But it's early days.
Talk about those events and reports, of course. But I just want to ask, since it so happens that we're sitting here in Peru, all places, talking about this for different reasons. But and we have been. You and I have seen so many fantastic megalithic sites.
That, oh, absolutely. I mean, defy explanation.
Defy explanation. And you might, it's not implausible that there might have been some extraterrestrial entities here.
Absolutely. I mean,
steering this thing up. So would you have any opinion about that? Or do you
No, I'm very open to the idea that we've been visited in the past, because through ancient megaliths, structures, petroglyphs, those kind of thing, you know, all around the world there are strange rock art petroglyphs that don't appear to show human figures. You know, there are some spectacular ones in Australia.
Yeah.
There are some spectacular ones in North America. In fact, all around the world. So, I absolutely am open to the idea. But the only problem is with that is we can never actually prove it. We can speculate and we can say, well, it could be, but we'll never go prove it. We want to live in the real world now, evidentially, and obviously my...
You and ICER.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking as the Vice President of ICER, we're very much evidential and scientific based. And we think now is the time that the data is there and it should be studied. And I think that the more it is studied, the more it will point to you're dealing with something that's off world.
Yeah. I think most listeners and viewers are know about this, what the Pentagon released last year. I think it was last year.
Yes, yeah, December. December.
A memorandum, brief memorandum, but it disclosed that there were more than 140 documented sightings of.
The report was published on the 25th of June,
2021.
Which was a month after he launched. We did it. We came out a month earlier, purposely to strategically place ourselves a month before its launch.
Yeah.
When it came out, it basically said of 144 cases, they couldn't explain 143. If anybody has followed the UFO subject and keen developments in the last 4 or 5 years, since 2017, there's been really a sea change.
And there was a report in the New York Times.
Started it, and then there were the release of three US Navy confirmed and authenticated videos that showed something clearly moving around. And because these were Navy authenticated videos, I think really for the first time the media could ask the question, what is that? And of course the pilots who've since gone on the record in several of these incidents have basically said they were dealing something which they'd never seen before, and the way the objects moved was quite unlike anything they'd ever seen. So pointing to a likely extraterrestrial explanation.
You think it's genuinely, is this genuinely new stuff or is it old?
No, I don't think the objects and their maneuvers are nothing new in terms of UFO research. We're talking about cases of instant acceleration, instant stop, vertical climb, vertical descent, you know, right angle turns. These have been noted since the 1940s. Obviously, because of the way the subject was treated stigma-wise, nobody really accepted that, or it was never really publicised in the mainstream because it was kind of laughed at. But now, many scientists are now getting involved in UAP research, and I think one of the reasons for that is that I think our level of technology is advanced to the stage where certainly military sensors on board ships, on board aircraft, are picking these things up in a way that they couldn't do before. So now there is a way to track them, a way to record the data, and of course that data needs studying. But you know, when we talk about what we're dealing with, even though the press, the mainstream press, would like to think that this is foreign adversary, as in China,
that's what you read
and
sometimes,
Russia, you talk to people who are involved at the sharp end of this, the likes of Chris Mellon, Luis Elizondo, who ran the ATIP program, they're saying literally it's a 1% chance.
Okay.
And that's a small 1%.
There because the carrot. Yeah, all the three videos, there are three videos.
Yeah, three videos, but there's subsequently been several more. There's another one that was released by Jeremy Corbell, showing an object that seems to be on the alongside a ship, military ship, that then suddenly is there, and then it appears to dip below the water and go out of sight. And there's no splash or anything like that. So there are some authenticated videos now. And the last year's American legislation was absolutely historic, because what it said was, for the first time, the intelligence community, all the, you know, the CIA, the NSA, etc., they had to deliver a classified report to Congress twice a year, and an unclassified report once a year.
That's unique.
That's unique. Never happened before, because it was always the intelligence community had really controlled this subject. But now, by law, signed off by the president, they have to report. Well, it now, as we're, you know, here in Peru, the second report, classified report, was due to be released on the 31st of October and delivered to Congress. Well, there's some debate about whether that's happened or not.
Okay.
But it certainly hasn't received any real press
Sounds
attention
shady.
Yet. Well, I think that's because, in all honesty, the intelligence community don't really want to respond.
No.
So they like kicking and screaming, being told that they have to do it, but they don't want to do it because they've controlled the subject for far too long. But what we do know is that when there was a classified briefing to Congress and Senate last year, many of the senators and Congress people were like shown 40 minutes of UFO videos, and many of them have gone on to say that the hair stood up on the back of their heads, and they felt they were watching something like science fiction.
Yeah.
So that kind of says where we're at. Now that's the obviously the classified world. The unclassified world, we're dealing with 2 or 3 minutes of videos, poor grainy videos.
Yeah.
But we know that the better stuff is out there, because many of the senators have actually gone on record.
What kind of entities out there do you think could be visiting us like that, in that way?
Well,
I've seen in these videos.
And ICER put out a statement last year, I think it was October time last year, where we basically said, look, having examined the whole abduction phenomena that's been really in the modern era for about the last 20 years or so, although there were earlier cases from the 50s, but over the last 20 years, in all countries around the world, even third world countries, they basically tell the same story. And so we put out a press statement on behalf of ISIS to say, look, we've examined the best cases from around the world. We believe that we are dealing with something non-human.
Yeah.
Now, if you accept that, when you look at the broad abduction scenario across the world, there are 5 main species that seem to be identified. The what we call the small grey, the tall grey, the Nordics, which are supposedly like Swedish blonde ending, you know, you could be that, you could be one of them. The mantids and the reptilians, they crop up all over the world. So that would seem to me that there are at least 5 species interacting with people on a certain level. How much governments know, especially the American government, we don't know. We only know 10% in the public domain. I would think that they know a hell of a lot more, but we probably will never find out.
Yeah, I listened to you yesterday talking about these things, and you mentioned, of course, Roswell.
Roswell,
the first event that's kicked this thing off in the modern era, at least. And there's so many legends and myths around that, and what happened, what actually happened, if they retrieved a UFO, and whether there were living creatures still there, and whether they have.
The
so what's your assessment on this?
I believe Roswell was real. I believe that they recovered some kind of crashed flying disc, which is actually what they said until it was retracted 6 hours later after they went press and it kind of went viral. I have spoken to Don Schmidt, who's a US-based researcher, who's one of our, the national representative for North America and a member of our executive council, the European, the North American director for North America and Canada. And I've spoken to him several times about Roswell, and he says there is so much wealth of evidence. You know, I think he said there was something like incidental information involving 800 witnesses. And he's very evidential based, and it clearly, everything that went on afterwards does not ring true if it were a weather balloon or a crash test dummy or something like that, which are really implausible excuses. You know, so I think Roswell was real. The question whether they retrieved bodies, well, if you recovered a craft, you may well have found bodies. Yeah. It may well not, but we'll never prove that. But we suspect that bodies probably were recovered. Whether some were alive or anything like that, we don't know. It's all speculation. But do I think that there was a real event involving a crash disc? Yes, I do. Mm. Yes, I do.
Has the US government told the public anything of this over the years?
They've basically just allowed the US Air Force to deny it. And like the 50th anniversary, so 1997, they did released a book that's saying, you know, it was basically a crash test dummy. But then researchers found out that the crash test dummies were 6 foot amorphic human-like figures, whereas all the witnesses described small, 3 foot tall.
Right, yeah. Like the creatures. Grays?
Yeah, the grays, yeah. So nothing to say, and also that the amorphic dummies occurred 4 or 5 years after Roswell. Mm. That plan wasn't in operation at the time. So I think they didn't really do a very good job at trying to kill it off. And I know that people like Luis Elizondo, having talked to him, would say that he thinks that something definitely happened.
So would you go so far as to say that the US government has lied to the public for 35 years?
They've lied to the government from my point of view, and you know, and probably ISA would say it too, but personally from my own point of view, I believe the evidence is very clear that the US government, which has dominated the UFO subject since 1947.
Yeah, other governments have taken it.
Yes, I think they've followed America's lead because they were the big superpower. And I think they have basically led a campaign of disinformation on the best UFO cases, deliberately, maybe for our own benefit. Not impossible that it's for our own benefit. Maybe they know things that they don't want to tell us because it'd be too frightening. I allow for that possibility, but the point is, I think the bottom line is you can't keep lying, and I think we're quite close to, through technology, them losing control. For example, if you've heard of the Phoenix Lights incident from 1997.
Wanted to give us a couple of more salient, prominent examples and spectacular
examples. Well, I think now, the Phoenix Lights incident was 1997. And basically, maybe 100,000 people saw a boomerang-shaped object moving silently across the sky that eventually ended up and stopped and hovered above Phoenix. Now, at the time, several videos were taken, but the video technology then, the picture quality was poor, and so it wasn't good enough to conclusively prove one way or the other. None showed the craft itself, were able to define the craft. They showed lights that appeared to show the rim of an edge, but it wasn't, the quality wasn't there to definitively prove it. Well, you think where we are now, 25 years on, most people carry smartphone technology phones, often phones with 4K, 8K is even becoming possible on some of the phones now. Now, we also have social media where you can go live streaming through the likes of Facebook, etc. Now, I think we're one major incident away from a cataclysm or a tipping point. Tipping point's really the point. And I think that basically, you know, if the Phoenix Lights incident were to happen in 2022, 23, everybody would be live streaming it, and you then could not control the media in the way that they'd been able to before.
Yeah, no.
I think people would just catch on. Major UFO sighting, everybody's going to be out there filming, and you're going to have thousands upon thousands of live streaming events capturing some kind of object.
What do you think would happen with the public? How many would panic?
I think I don't think that many would, but I think a proportion would. Yeah. And certainly from ISIS's point of view, we speculate maybe 15 or 20% of the public would be psychologically frightened to the point of trauma, mental health issues. Because there's no two ways about it. If it's confirmed that there is an extraterrestrial civilization or civilizations interacting with our society now, some people are going to say, well, it's like Independence Day, and they might be frightened,
yeah, I mean,
etc.
It upends everything that we've been taught.
Almost. And yes, and because they've been lied to for 75 years, literally, then I think a proportion of the public will feel very vulnerable.
Yes.
I think the world will carry on. I think people will still go to work in the same way, will still go on holiday, but a proportion will be affected by it. And I think that's what ITER is trying to say is, you know, we shouldn't allow this, you know, train careering down a track and then it's going to hit a brick wall. We can prevent that by preparing people through educational needs. And that's what we're trying to do.
What do you think will happen with religion?
It's often been debated, and certainly there was a Brookings Institute report in 1960 that speculated that there might be huge effect on religion at that time. But I think, again, as speculation has increased over the years, we've seen, like, for example, the Catholic faith. Several cardinals have gone on the record to say, you know, if there is extraterrestrial life, it's all part of God's plan, and we would be happy to baptize them. So I think a lot of religions now are becoming, from a theological point of view, are open now to think that we're not alone in the universe.
Okay. There's also a case that I know you've studied deeply in England, I think it was in England in 1980.
Yes, the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Yes.
Yeah, December
1980. Tell us a little bit about that one.
It's now regarded as the second most famous UFO case in history, after Roswell. So it's a case that's, you know, very highly regarded.
I should have known about it, but I'm just a layman.
Well, no, it basically is very important because it's not one sighting. It's a series of sightings and a series of interactions, mainly with US Air Force military personnel, mostly US Air Force security police, who encounter objects and possible entities over several consecutive nights. So that's what elevates it to something more than just a single event. This is a series of events, and there is documentation through a US Air Force document that was released in 1983 called the Holt Memorandum. That was written by the Deputy Base Commander, Lieutenant Charles Holt, and he basically said that there was a confirmed triangular craft seen by US Air Force security police on one night, and then two nights later he gets involved in another ongoing incident involving UFOs, and he sees multiple UFOs himself. And so for him to go on the record with his rank, Lieutenant Colonel, is very, very rare that happens. And of course, you're talking, you know, the US Air Force indirectly admitting that there was a landed craft of unknown origin in the forest that had no markings, that was not Chinese, Russian or whatever. It infers something else.
And one of the officers actually touched
Jim Peniston, from the first night, he touched the craft, he took photographs. The photographs come out fogged, but he made sketches and whatever and touched the craft, and he described it as being black glass-like material. But he noted that on the craft there was a 2-foot-sized area that was like etching that had race symbols. So he made a note of those in his pocketbook. And you know, it's a very famous case, but there's been a lot of disinformation by the authorities to try to, I think, play down the significance, certainly by the Air Force, the US Air Force, the British Royal Air Force, the British government, the US government. They've tried to play it down. Now, I've been doing a reinvestigation over the last 5 years, and I've uncovered a lot of new information, and that will come out soon, within the next 6 months. But I believe
you can't tell when.
No. But within the next 6 months, for certain. But we're looking at, I think, a rewrite of the narrative. It's definitely, I would say, UFO
of that incident, or
of the whole incident.
The whole incident. Yeah.
Many more sightings that have been that I found, talked to military personnel who've now gone on the record. Yeah. Other incidents we weren't aware of in the forest and on the bases.
Looking forward to that.
So it will be contentious because I think the narrative of Rendlesham Forest has been quite carefully controlled for the last 25 years.
There's a lot of stuff going on in England. I have heard you say also that there's a connection between the UFO phenomenon and crop circles. How in what way?
I know several crop circle researchers. I'm not a crop circle researcher myself, but they will say that there is a small percentage of crop circles every year that are genuine mystery.
And that most are fake.
Yes, 95% plus are fake, made by professional circle makers, as like kind of graffiti art, from aerial graffiti. But there is a small percentage every year that appear genuine, and the crop circle researchers go in there, and many of the, it would appear that they are very quickly made, within minutes or seconds, that they're like imprinted, that there is a burst of microwave energy or some kind of energy that flattens them into the shape of whatever design is going to be laid down. But noticeably, when you examine under a microscope, say the nodes of a corn, then you will find that the knuckles, the joints of the corn, perhaps two or three, have been blown out from the inside. At the knuckle point, they just explode outward, as if being subjected to some kind of great heat. And that's typical of what we would call a genuine crop circle. So whilst most are not mysterious and are made by humans, there is a small percentage that are definitely under the UFO umbrella.
Crafts been seen hovering over the areas where...
Yes, but not usually craft. What you have seen, and there are some various videos that have been taken over the years, small white orbs are seen in daylight, flying above crop circles or near them, and they've been filmed, you know, in the vicinity of crop circles. So there does appear to be some kind of connection.
Fascinating. I understand that there is not as much consensus within the UFO community as you would have liked, but maybe that ICER is a part of the attempts to make people come together more.
I think historically, if you look at the subject of UFOs worldwide, internationally, there are some excellent researchers in many, many countries and have done fantastic work over the decades. But unfortunately, the UFO community has very rarely come together on an international basis. When you think that this subject's really been around for 70 years, you know, certainly since the early 50s, and worldwide, you'd think it would have a much more powerful political, not as in a political dogma, but as in a collective body of force to say government should be doing this and doing that. And I think that's because groups couldn't agree on things. And that's
how to alert the public.
I mean, there was a brilliant organization called NICAP, led by Major Donald Kehoe in the 60s, and that the 50s and 60s, and that was the best example, because that was made up heavily by military personnel and scientists who had seen things, and they were putting pressure on the government. But that was effectively infiltrated by the CIA, later destroyed from within, and Major Donald Kehoe was ousted as chairman eventually in 1970. So there's been powerful forces that have tried to play the subject down. But since then, there's not really been an international coalition, as it were. And ICER aims to fill that gap by saying, look, you know, it's now time, we're on the brink of this paradigm shift, and we need to start preparing the public for what is going to be a huge shock, because you have been lied to. without a shadow of a doubt. And that will create a backlash. From a personal point of view, as and when that disclosure moment happens, I think there will be a lot of anger released by the public, the media. The media, I would argue, have been complicit, but most journalists were not complicit. They it was on high. It was done at a very, very high level.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, TV and things like that have produced documentaries that didn't want to rock the boat, didn't want to create pressure.
Play the same game as the politicians.
So I think as and when we talk about this big disclosure of the Big D happening, and you'll know when it's happening because you'll turn on the news and it'll be on every news channel 24/7 like a terrorist incident.
Yeah.
That's when you'll know it's real.
Yeah.
But realistically, I think that when that happens, there will be a lot of people genuinely angry that they've been lied to for 75 years. Well, I kind of think, well, how do we deal with that in a non-violent way?
Mm.
Because people could really get very angry. But I personally have speculated, based on the apartheid example in South Africa, where they had truth and reconciliation hearings. And I think that's what we should do.
Sure.
And just say, look, if you're a senior person who's been involved in this secrecy, just give your testimony. Just put it out there. You're not going to get attacked. You're not going to go to prison. Mm. But basically, let's just get this story out there once and for all and move on and deal with whatever we're going to deal with.
Yeah.
That would be my way of dealing with the anger.
Sounds very wise, I must say. You mentioned earlier this the new law in the United States that requires the military to
the whistleblower. To
submit, well, that's another one, because you mentioned this the rule that the military has to disclose what they've found to the Congress every 6 months.
Yeah. Well,
but then there's the whistleblower amendment.
That's what's happening this year. That's different. So last year was legislation that said the intel community had to report to Congress by law. That was passed bipartisan, signed off by President Biden. This year, a new amendment has been created that will effectively, it's been interpreted as a whistleblower amendment. And what that means is that it's long been suspected that many, certainly military people, have been involved in black projects that are really off the grid.
Yeah.
Nobody knew about them, and they've been working on UFO projects. Well, the whistleblower amendment is basically going to say, you're not going to lose your pension. You now can come forward and disclose this story in the public good. And I think that's likely to become law by the end of December.
Mm-hmm.
So by early 2023, I think it's envisaged, and apparently
floodgates will open.
Yeah, well, the possibility of floodgates. It might not be. It might be very slow at first, because people, I think, would be very nervous.
They can't really trust this.
Yes, yeah.
This,
is this for real kind of thing? However, what we have heard from the likes of Chris Mellon and Luis Elizondo is that I would think US military witnesses are being approached to give testimony before open congressional hearings that may take place as early as spring of 2023.
Spectacular.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's potentially when we're on the brink of a change in terms with the mainstream media.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, whilst there's been a lot of coverage in the United States, many countries are still dragging their heels, still want to think it's China or Russia or something like that.
Mm.
However, when...
Maybe that's only on the surface? And
certainly that's the way it's portrayed mainstream-wise. Maybe behind the scenes it might not be. But I suspect that if there are live witness congressional hearings, for the first time the public are going to hear direct testimony from people who have been involved in nuclear weapons shutdowns, missile silos, like in 1967 with Captain Robert Salas, a friend of mine.
Tell us a little bit about that incident.
Well, basically, Captain Robert Salas in 1967, Malmstrom, it was kind of Midwest, he was underground in his bunker, basically 10 intercontinental ballistic missiles, i.e. if the Soviets launched their missiles, we'd launch ours, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the person who would turn the key, the dual key. He was one of those people. Well, he gets a phone call from his topside security guard saying there's a UFO shining a beam down into the bunker, to his underground bunker. And he's like 50, 100 feet underground. And then all suddenly, 10 nuclear weapons go offline, ballistic missiles, one by one. And they're not designed to go offline. because of what they're dealing with, nuclear weapons, they have many safeguard systems built in, and yet they were overridden, and 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, yeah. went off one by one, and everybody's panicking. The UFO stops the beam, and off they go, off it goes. Eventually, they're checked. Nothing wrong with them. Mm. They've just been switched off by some unknown means. And so when I think the public hear that from a direct witness yeah. who's there.
And back then he wasn't allowed to, I mean, he
no.
was
well,
to.
No, that he was, to, yeah, to quite yeah, yeah. But we've got all the documents since then mm. to prove it, plus one of his people in charge of him corroborated and confirmed that the incident happened. And it's not alone. There have been incidents, several incidents over the years, 70s, 80s in particular, with nuclear weapon shutdowns in America, but also during the Soviet era, in 1982, I believe it was, in what was former Ukraine, a Soviet weapon, nuclear weapons bunker, did the opposite. It went into launch mode. Hmm. A UFO was seen shining a beam down into the bunker, hmm. and then suddenly the missiles went into launch mode. I.e., something had switched them on. Yes. It was only apparently for about 15 seconds, but apparently 10 missiles came on,
yeah.
going down, this ready to go kind of thing, and nobody could explain it. Again, fail-safe systems shouldn't have allowed that to happen. But again, UFO shining a beam down. And you can only interpret these kind of incidents as some kind of, you shouldn't be messing with nuclear weapons. We don't know that for certain, no. but that's what you would
Might
logically...
be what they're trying to tell us.
Yes. Yeah. And the fact is, you can only describe them as demonstrations of their capabilities,
exactly.
technological capabilities.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think if the public start hearing about these incidents, mm. they're going to go, what? This
yeah.
is for real?
They should.
They should,
yeah.
They should, but also the press will hopefully report on it properly and it'll
yeah.
be live.
Yeah. So what do you foresee now would happen with our knowledge about UFOs and ET presence in the coming, say, 3, 4, 5 years with all this new legislation coming?
I think that the legislation changes are huge. If the whistleblower amendment goes through, the implications for this subject, again, huge, because we could be faced with an avalanche of really high quality cases that we didn't know about, corroborated incidents, high, you know, very senior military people come out of the woodwork. And I think if that happens, that can only create pressure on what I call the dam. And eventually the dam will break. And when it breaks, that's when you get disclosure. It's not going to be a slow trickle. It'll culminate in a collapse.
You think so?
Yes, I think because it'll reach a point of no return. And at the moment, we're edging towards that with this legislation, proposed legislation. So I think, you know, within the next 2 to 3 years, we could really have this paradigm shift. And everybody, regardless of your beliefs, acknowledges that as and when official contact is acknowledged, that it will be the most profound moment in human history.
Yeah.
You know, and it surely would be, because it would answer that age-old question, we're not alone.
A new era will begin.
A new era will begin.
We might also have contact with other galaxies and whatever.
And I suppose the logical question after that is there ongoing communication now in the secret world
mm-hmm.
that might become more public? They might release some information that they may have had contact in the secret world. But if not, it's, yes, we're acknowledging that they're real, they're not ours, it's non-human. Mm. Now the question would be, well, how do we communicate with these things?
Mm.
Maybe we're just ants in the playground. We may be very primitive.
Yes.
So they might not want to talk to us. We might just kill them if they land on the White House lawn.
Mm.
That's the way humans are. Mm. But we've got to get beyond that.
Do you think
that.
We're capable of doing that, killing them, even?
Well,
depending on what type of ETs we're talking about.
The logical thing to think is that, from my point of view as a UFO researcher, I believe that these things have been around for the last 75 years and probably
a lot longer,
but certainly in the last 75 years. The capabilities and the movements that are described now are no different from what was seen in the 40s. So there's nothing different. I suspect that if they have that technological capability, they could have easily taken over the Earth had they wanted to. The fact that they haven't, and they've more or less kept secret apart from the contact side through abduction phenomena, says that they're basically just to watch us and probably just study us in the same way that we would go to the Great Barrier Reef and study the fish, or the Galapagos Islands and study all the unique forms of life there. I think we're probably a special area of interest.
Yeah.
For me, I often get asked the question, you know, why here? And I think, well, I don't really know, but I speculate that the Earth is kind of rare.
Yeah.
In our bit of cosmic neighbourhood, it's like an oasis in the desert. It's a very special jewel. And I think that from an alien perspective, this is a very interesting planet.
Yeah.
So rich and diverse in life and fauna.
Yeah.
It's only thousands upon thousands of different life.
Yeah.
I think we're a very interesting planet, and probably we also hold a lot of water.
And they're betting on whether we are going to make it or not now.
Well, perhaps. you'd like to think that they might say, well, yes, there's nothing to say that they're overly aggressive. There have been incidents where people have been harmed, but they're very rare.
Mm.
So you'd have to look at the greater 75 years and say there doesn't appear to be an overt threat.
No.
That shouldn't change, in my opinion.
No.
So I'm optimistic that we can work this through. But what we've got to do is recognise that it's time to stop lying to the public.
Exactly.
And really come together as the human race. Which is what ISA is all about, and saying, you know, we're not multiple species, we are the human race. We are just one species.
Mm-hmm.
And we now need to sit around the table and say, how do we deal with this new paradigm shift?
Wonderful note to end on, I think. Gary, it's been a pleasure and fascinating to talk to you. Good luck now with all this
work. Thank you, and anytime.